Again, the question is even more difficult, trying to understand what the purpose of the nes was. So you're saying that it was unnecessary to set it up that way. Why don't we ask a more basic question? Trying to find more. Okay. Well, let's ask an even more basic question. The nes happened. What was the significance of the nes? What did the nes gain? What? They weren't able. That the oil continued to burn for the full 8 days. That was the nes. Should have gone out after a day. Burned for 8 days straight. Okay. Now, why was that important? Meaning, nes, you don't find, I don't think you find anywhere else, very rarely, a nes that happens in order to enable one to perform a mitzvah. The whole concept of a mitzvah is that you do everything in your ability, and beyond that, you're exempt. Right? Nisim happen to save someone from danger. Right? Think about all the nisim that you've heard of.
It's always the
Baal Shem
Tov stories.
I'm still in Chazal. But nisim happened to save someone from danger, something like that. With a mitzvah, on the contrary, it's not incumbent on us to see to it that it gets done even if we can't do it. And as much as you can do it, do it. If not, you're potter. And even more than that, the Jews didn't do the mitzvah. Even if you say that, no, there is a purpose in making a nes in order to enable us to fulfill a mitzvah. The mitzvah is to light the menorah every day. They didn't. Right? The lamp burned for 8 days straight. If you want to throw in a little more even, throw in Reb Chaim Brisker as the question. He says, wasn't even kasha. He says, because you're commanded to light the menorah from olive squeezed from oil. This was miraculous oil. You're not supposed to light on miraculous oil. You're supposed to light on natural oil that's squeezed from olives. What was there the second, third, fourth day was already a yesh me'ayin kind of thing. It was a creation ex nihilo. It wasn't. So, this is a question. The truth is that many ask the question, what was the purpose of Nes Chanukah? What was so special about it? Why is it such cause for celebration? There were a lot of other nisim throughout the years that happened to all kinds of righteous people. Why this? It's all kinds of things that seem more significant that don't have a Yom Tov. Right? It was the miracle of Yeshua crossing the Yarden. Right? The miracle of the sun stopping for Yeshua. You start going through Nach. All kinds of great miracles. The miracle of Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah coming out of the fiery furnace. Right? It says in the Gemara that when each of these things happened, they said Hallel at the time, and that was that. Right? No Yom Tov. So, why is this all of a sudden so much more significant than all of those other occurrences? Why 8 days? Because in order to go to get the right olives to produce another batch of oil took 8 days. Yeah. So it took eight. What's that? It's right. And so therefore they need 8 days to come tide them over until then. That's problem number one. Now let's move on to the other miracle. They won the wars. What's the significance here? Huh? Oh, so the Talmid, okay. But that's not what's stressed. What's stressed is the miraculous salvations. Those were very big nisim. But still, what exactly is being celebrated? Are we celebrating the fact that the Jews drove out the Greeks and that they won the war? Historically, it's not quite so. Because when did they establish the miracle of Hanukkah? When they came into the Beis HaMikdash, they lit the menorah and they had the nes. You know that at that time, many people don't know this. I once had a whole argument about this with somebody. He said that the essence of the Yom Tov of Hanukkah is celebrating the fact that the Jews regained the rule. That's a historic mistake. Because at the time, again, it was established when the time of the Nes Chanukah happened. Many people don't know that after that, the Greeks regained power, drove the Jews out of Yerushalayim. After that, four of the five Maccabee brothers were killed in battle, right? The Nes of the oil was very far from marking the happy ending. It wasn't. The truth is that there was not really a happy ending. It wasn't really a happy ending. Never really ended happily. Four of the five Maccabee brothers were afterwards killed in battle. Afterwards, the truth is that the decrees against the Jews reached their peak after the Nes Hanukkah. It reached a situation where the Greeks regained control of all of Eretz Israel. The Hashmonaim were holed up in a small stronghold called Michmash. Right? This was all after the Nes Hanukkah. Battles continued. There were many bloody years after the Nes Hanukkah, until quite a number of years later, I forget now, something like 21 years later, the one surviving son of Matisyahu, the one Hashmonai that was left, Shimon, ended up reaching an understanding with the Greeks, and they left him alone, and they left, and he established and solidified his rule over Eretz Yisrael. That was really... So there was no victory at the time of the Nes Hanukkah. Meaning, there was a temporary victory. They held the Beis HaMikdash for a short time. And the Nes Hanukkah happened then. But, obviously, Nes Hanukkah is not celebrating victory. There wasn't a full-fledged victory then.
Shimon was over all Eretz Israel, or just over that little place called Rishon?
No. Ultimately, he ended up becoming the ruler of all of Eretz Israel.
Greeks left all of Eretz Israel alone?
I don't think completely left, but yeah, they basically recognized his rule at one point, yeah. It was at the negotiating table. It wasn't like they drove him out and that was that. They reached agreements. So what is the Nes? What is the celebration? So here we have to understand. I have to really get a good historic perspective in order to appreciate what we're celebrating here. Let's understand another thing. At the time when the Nes Hanukkah happened, let's not think. It was very, very different than Purim. There was no confetti in the air. It's not like, Purim was, it says, Vayirshu Shansa Lovisamecha, there was rejoicing, dancing. At the time of the Nes Hanukkah, let's realize, the country was ravaged. The country was ravaged. It had been torn apart after years of persecution. Many people... I don't know if it was thousands or hundreds of thousands or what the numbers were. People were killed over the years. And everybody had either relatives, right? When the time, when the Nes Hanukkah happened, or even at the point when it reached its ending at the end, the dead people didn't come back. And also, many people had defected, right? Many had become Hellenists. Many of them didn't come back either. The situation in Eretz Yisrael was tragic. We're talking about, at the time of the Nes Hanukkah, we were talking about a broken down land, a ravaged land, traumatized people. There was no confetti in the air. In fact, the menorah itself, they didn't even have a golden menorah. The menorah that the Nes Hanukkah happened in was a substitute that they made at the time. It wasn't even gold. They just kind of made a makeshift menorah. That's what the Nes happened in. We're not talking about a situation where there was this glorious ending with confetti in the air. What was the Nes? What was the Nes? So, here, I'm going to insert an annoying little anecdote, which will help begin getting the point of where we're headed tonight. There was a Jew by the name of Rabbi Yehuda Davis. This was one of the first American-bred Gedolei Torah. He was in the same class as Rabbi Avigdor Miller and Rabbi Nosson Vachfoigel and Rabbi Moshe Bick, some of the big American names. He was in their class. In fact, he was a leader of the group. He inspired some of the well-known Rabbanim of America to go to Europe to learn, among them Rabbi Miller. He ultimately became known as the Rosh Hashiva of Monticello. Rabbi Yehuda Davis. But Monticello is in the Catskills area, I don't know exactly where, but this upstate New York. Yeah. In the Catskills, yeah. Yeah. So he was the Rosh Yeshiva there. Before that, he had an interesting position. He was the principal of secular studies in one of the yeshivas in New York. The principal of secular studies. And that sounds like a strange position for a man who was a big-time Torah authority, but the truth is, Rabbi Avigdor Miller always used to say, secular studies are to be held in a yeshiva, and if it's going to be done right, you have to have the principal of secular studies has to be a greater person than the Rosh Yeshiva. That's what Avigdor Miller said. Whatever it is, that was the case in this instance. But he was in charge of secular studies. Now, basically, what his job consisted of was, meaning, the main thing he did was disqualify books. Right? Part of his job was to review the books they would be using. And math books is one thing, but history, etc. And he gave the board a very hard time, because until he let a book pass, and if you saw what the book looked like by the time he was finished with it, you know, he cut out these pages and those pages and that. By the time he let it into the curriculum of the yeshiva, he gave them a very hard time. But the straw that broke the camel's back was when he disqualified a book, because this book was a book apparently of Jewish history, and it said the Maccabees were a band of mighty warriors. And he said, no good, the book goes. And that already said, hey, you're already going too far. He said, we can't continue taking this. They're going to disqualify a book because it calls the Maccabees a band of mighty warriors. They ended up bringing the question to Rabbi Aaron Cutler. It was a whole discussion. Okay, well, whatever it is, what did he want? What bothered him so much about this? The truth is, I don't know. I never met him and I never asked him. But if we'll understand well what really the cause of celebration of Hanukkah was, what it was that made them go so crazy, we might have some insight into this question. So we have to go back again and get some historic perspective in the setting in which Hanukkah took place. Hanukkah was in the earlier half of the second Beis Hamikdash. Right? Now, we have to realize what the significance of that period was. After the first Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, the glory of the Jewish people ended. And when the second Beis Hamikdash was built, it wasn't like they came back to their previous glory. The first Beis Hamikdash was the full effect of the Shekhinah's presence in Eretz Yisrael, which manifested in supernatural ways not only in the Beis Hamikdash but all around the country. One of the main things it manifested in was Nevuah. Nevuah, we stress this often. You have to realize what Nevuah was. Nevuah was not a technicality. Hashem had to get across a message, so he tapped someone on the shoulder and gave him the message. Nevuah meant that you can connect to the highest of places. The way the Kuzari puts it is that Nevuah was experiencing Olam Haba in this world. To get a tap on the shoulder from Hashem and to get a direct revelation Hashem actually converses with you is experiencing Olam Haba in this world. He says once a person had Nevuah, he had no more fear of dying. He looked forward to it because he already had a taste of what it's like in the next world. It was so intense, the experience of Nevuah, that the person receiving the prophecy couldn't handle it. The human body couldn't contain it. They would drop and lose their senses. And they would lie on the floor in convulsions when they had Nevuah. Unless he was someone like Moshe Rabbeinu who was able to take it standing up. Right? But the Nevi'im couldn't handle it. They would drop on the floor. It was so intense that the Kuzari says, a person witnessing a prophet getting Nevuah was a changed person forever. Right? So Nevuah was a very, very fundamental part of Jewish life. Whenever there was some issue, the word of Hashem was conveyed through the Navi. I have to understand, it's not just that. It's not like we know of the 48 Nevi'im. But actually, Chazal tell us that there were 1.2 million Nevi'im in Klal Yisrael. Just what we only know of the ones who were sent to deliver messages to the entire Jewish people, which were relevant for all of eternity. Those are the ones whose Nevuahs were recorded. But there were all kinds of people getting Nevuahs on a personal basis. I once made the cheshbon, approximately. It comes out that there was a Navi every two or three buildings. So we're talking in terms of our neighborhoods. There was a Navi every two or three buildings. There were more Nevi'im than there were rabbis. And we have Rabbanim in our community. A lot more. Every two or three buildings there was a Navi. No. 1.2 million throughout the period of Nevuah. We're talking about a bit more than 400 years. It's not as much as 1.2 million at one time, but it's still quite a bit. Comes out when you distribute it over those that amount of years. It comes out approximately to a Navi every three buildings. There was a Navi. Okay? Now, when the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, Nevuah started waning. Less and less and less. The second Beis HaMikdash was rebuilt. It was a far cry from what the first Beis HaMikdash was. Right? The first Beis HaMikdash, the Shekhinah was manifest in a very open way, with all kinds of open miracles going on all the time. Second Beis HaMikdash, there was barely any of that. It was already, the lights were basically off. Now, as Nevuah started waning, basically what that meant was that open channel with Hashem, which was such a integral part of who the Jewish people are, was starting to turn off. The curtains were starting to close. The lights were starting to dim. Then, at the beginning of the first Beis HaMikdash, there still were some Nevi'im. There were a handful of Nevi'im left at the second Beis HaMikdash, the beginning of the second Beis HaMikdash. Slowly, they died out. Nevuah had ended. Now, for us, we don't really appreciate the magnitude of what that means, because we've been living already for 2,000 years without Nevuah. So what's the big deal? We have to appreciate, for a person who grew up with Nevuah, the thought of a reality, of existence, Jewish existence without Nevuah was unthinkable. Right? What, without, what are the Jewish people without that direct connection to the word of Hashem? What are the Jewish people? Okay? Now, but that ended. Yet, there were still certain signs of supernatural presence. In the time of Shimon HaTzadik, there were still certain miracles going on in the Beis HaMikdash. But, slowly, also these things came to a stop. Shimon HaTzadik died, and the few miracles that still, the few much diluted miracles that still existed in his time, came to a close. Basically, as far as the Jewish people were concerned, the lights were dimming. What Judaism used to be was dying. Okay. From that point and on, it was just downhill. It was just downhill. After a while, there's already no open miracles. It's as though the lines to Hashem are now shut. Okay. Then what happens? All right. The Jews are continuing to observe. Right, today, again, today it doesn't seem novel to us that a person observes, keeping Torah mitzvahs without Nevuah. But again, think about it in those times. From the perspective of those times, people lived with the word of Hashem. When suddenly that's it, Hashem is not in touch anymore, it basically seems like, we just mentioned this the Mincha time shir. Atem etzien azavani Hashem. That's it, Hashem basically is not in touch with the Jewish people anymore. He moved on, right? There's no more Nevuah. People are still holding on, but it was very, very demoralizing. At that point, the state was a very demoralizing state. Then you move on. They're still keeping Torah mitzvahs, right? They're still serving Hashem. There still is a Beis HaMikdash. They're still doing the Avodah. But then, Greek culture starts to spread with all of its accompanying idolatry, etc. And it's starting to take over the world. One by one, different nations are dropping all of their ancient, primitive lifestyles and cultures, and they're adopting the new light of humanity, the Greek culture, right? Making great advances. The Jewish people, of course, have their own culture. They're not interested. A minute. Or are they not? Depends who you ask. The Greeks took control of Eretz Yisrael, and they brought with them their culture. By and large, the Jews weren't interested. We have something better. But
by and large, the Maccabees were actually a minority.
Wait, I'm talking about from the beginning of the story. From the beginning of the story. But this situation starts slowly changing. It started, by the way, with politics. It's interesting to know how it started. You know how it started. This is an interesting tidbit of historic information. It started with all the Jewish people originally were observant, obviously. What happened? The Kohen Gadol became recognized by the non-Jewish authorities as the highest office of the Jewish people. And for them, he became the representative. So the Kohen Gadol basically served as the vassal of the Greeks. It was the one basically governing the Jewish people. That's why later, the position of Kohen Gadol became a coveted position. Became very corrupted because people would buy it from the Greek authorities. Whatever it is, the position of Kohen Gadol became responsible for the Jewish people toward the Greek authorities. Among the responsibilities were collecting tax. He had to provide, it was the Kohen Gadol's personal responsibility to provide the Greek authorities with the tax that was expected from the Jewish people. Now, one of the Kohanim Gedolim was an old man at one point. I forgot what his name was, it's not important. Old man, didn't have koyach, couldn't keep on top of things. He didn't collect the taxes. He had a nephew whose name was Toivia. Now, this Toivia was not the most conscientious guy, his head was in other things. And this guy saw a golden opportunity. Basically what happened was, he got his uncle to appoint him tax collector, with the idea being that his duty is to make sure that the Greeks get what they want, and anything beyond that, what he manages to collect, he can keep. So this basically turned into a mafia. He used to go with mercenaries, hired soldiers, and they would terrorize the rest of the Jewish people, they would extort them for taxes, and he would keep a very large cut. He gave the Greek authorities their cut. This really was where the deterioration started. But okay, this is not really our point. I just stuck that in parentheses. But whatever it is, what ended up as things developed, there were Jews who began becoming attracted to the Greek ways, the Greek culture, and inroads started setting in. Right? Decay started setting in. Jews. That's right. History repeats itself. Happens all the time. They were impressed by the latest advances. They were impressed by the sophisticated culture. They were wise enough and open-minded enough not to just stubbornly stick to a backward old lifestyle. And they started adopting Greek ways. And this started spreading. You have to understand that this wasn't so black and white. It wasn't like a family just decided, all right, from now on, kids, get rid of yarmulkes. We're becoming Hellenizers. No. For many people, you kind of do both. You can live in both worlds, right? You can remain observant, yet be a part of Greek entertainment, kind of try to distinguish between the kosher parts and the not kosher parts, confuse them a little bit also. In fact, at one point, there was a gymnasium built on Har HaBayis, right near the Beis HaMikdash. It's a good thing the Kehanim should be able to exercise in their spare time together with the Greeks. That's what went on. The Kehanim used to go to the... take breaks from the Avodah on the Beis HaMikdash and go play games naked with the Greeks in the gymnasium. Of course, it was embarrassing. They played naked. A Jew naked looks different than a guy naked. That was embarrassing. They would also pull their skin over their mila to make it not distinguishable.
Is that something you lose at home on the bar?
Yeah. I guess they weren't all that concerned about that at that point. But they were there to show that Jews can be cool too. And, like you said, history repeats itself. Okay, but the point here is that slowly but surely, many Jews became Hellenizers. Hellenism started spreading to the extent that it really started to seem that basically Greek culture was going to take over in Eretz Yisrael just like it took over in the rest of the world. Once Greek culture took over, let's say, in, some African country, let's say in Egypt, that's a good example. Egyptian culture was never restored. It was finished, right? There were the Egyptian Greeks, right? There was a very strong Greek settlement in Egypt. Alexandria, right? With a big city. Who's that named after? Alexander, right? Once Greek culture took hold, that was the end of Egyptian history. And of Egyptian culture. And this process began in Eretz Israel as well. If you were a Hellenizer, you could be confident that it's just a matter of time before Greek culture would take over. And, well, I'm not even talking intermarriage. I'm just talking about the Greek culture taking the place of Jewish culture. Let's say they all stay Jews. But Greek culture taking the place of Jewish culture, crowding out Jewish culture. And this was happening slowly but surely, to the extent that it reached the point that the loyal, like you said, were the minority. We're the minority. Now you have to realize, what's that?
The Hellenists still Shomer Shabbat.
So again, there was all kinds of degrees. Many of them completely were not at all. There were people, it seems, who kind of straddled until they went one way or the other. But whatever it is, from a realistic perspective at that time, it was clear that traditional Judaism was a flickering flame. It was a matter of time before it would go lost. Now, there are the loyal Jews that are holding on tenaciously. Initially, it was just an issue of social pressure. They're being ridiculed, they're being looked down upon, backward, primitive, etc. But then, it started getting even more unfriendly, right? It started reaching the point where their Jewish brethren couldn't handle the fact. By the way, I have to realize that too. The decrees were not initiated by the Greeks, they were initiated by the Jews, by the Hellenists. They couldn't handle the fact that these people, you see all the time, see it today too, couldn't handle the fact that these people are still holding on to the old ways. It's an eyesore, right? And therefore, they began zealously trying to just finally snuff it out, speed the process up. And they instigated the Greeks to impose the decrees. Whatever it is, the decrees started coming. No more Torah, etc. Okay. Here already it reached a point where the people had to be Moiser Nefesh. Self-sacrifice in order to continue keeping the Torah. Many people gave up their lives. Then it reached a point that many people, entire communities, went into hiding. They basically lived in unlivable conditions, right? They moved into caves, entire communities moved into caves in the wilderness, right? Imagine living with the whole family in a wet damp cave. You can't come out for fear for your life. Forests, mountains, right? They're killing themselves literally in order to keep Torah. But let's add also the psychological element. It's not just that they were killing themselves and they knew that there's a purpose. Add the psychological element. Imagine if you were a person with a little bit of a weak spine, a little bit of a weak backbone. You're killing yourself for what? This is also part of what they would be ridiculed for. You're kidding yourself for something that's going to be gone in 50 years anyways. Right? You're torturing yourself. And you're putting in such intense efforts to something that's going to be gone in 50 years anyways. That was clear from a statistical perspective. Right? Anybody who had a good awareness of reality saw that it's just a matter of time. What are you being obstinate for? Killing yourself. You're going to let your child be hung, dismembered, when it's such a waste. Maybe if you were going to keep it alive, one thing. But it was so clear to anybody realistic that it's a matter of time. 50 years, it's going to be gone anyway. It's flickering. There's nothing, doesn't have a continuation. Right? But these people lived with conviction. They lived with conviction that it's not that way. Even if realistically it seems that the Jewish faith is ending. And again, like we said before, this was the all-time low in the history of the Jewish people. Nevuah had ended. All the open signs of the Beis HaMikdash had ended. All signs of Hashem's presence had ended. As far as they were concerned, there was now no communication between them and Hashem. Okay? And again, this was new to them. You have to realize. And shortly after that, we're reaching a situation where basically Judaism is being snuffed out little by little. Okay? And they're hanging on. And they're doggedly hanging on. And they're fighting desperate battles. And then interesting things start happening. These dogged people, right? Fighting those desperate battles, have to think about it. You're talking about, 100 yeshiva guys fighting a unit of the U.S. Army. Right? Start thinking about that. Picture the scene. These are people who are untrained in battle and fighting the greatest, the most powerful army in the world. But amazing things start happening. They have a victory. And then they have another victory. And they are frustrating the mighty Greek army here, there, at every corner and turn. Now, these people were killing themselves. Might have even been easier for them to just give up and die. Right? No, they wanted to stay alive, and they wanted to battle, and they wanted to fight, they wanted to keep Torah alive. They wanted to keep Torah alive. They were killing themselves to do it, literally and figuratively, in every sense of the word. Right? But there was one thing that they were just so desperate for. They wanted to see if through all the years of connection with Hashem, and it wasn't in so far past that there had been open connection with Hashem. And here they're fighting and killing themselves, but there remains a situation of no communication. In earlier times, this would have gone into Nebuah. Nabi would come tell them, Hashem sees your efforts. And he, so says Hashem, you can have hope because nothing. They're fighting, they're killing themselves, people are dying, Al-Kiddush Hashem. Nothing, nothing. Radio silence from above. This was something that they were so desperate to see, some sign from Hashem, recognizing their efforts. Okay? But now, they suddenly started winning uncanny battles. And here was the big question. After the Jews came back, they had that ragtag group of 150 people, and they fought like Meshuggahs, and they just beat a unit of 10,000 Greek soldiers. And now they're coming back exhausted. By the way, you know, they went into battle fasting. They didn't go into battle well fed. They went into battle fasting. Finally coming back now. Now the question is, was this a miracle? Is this an open sign from Hashem that He's recognizing our, acknowledging our efforts, and He's crowning our efforts with success? Or, and this is how you'll hear people presenting it till this very day, or is the idea that the Jews demonstrated Jewish might, that they were a mighty group of warriors, right? And guerrilla warfare, and they were determined, and determination wins. If you would have told the Maccabim that, they would have been devastated. They were looking to see, they were so desperate to see a sign from Hashem recognizing their efforts. If they would be told, no, it makes sense, you folks are good commandos, here, you know, I'm going to pat you on the shoulder, kol hakavod, any nation would be proud of that. For them, that would have been completely defeating the purpose. It would take the air, it would take the significance out of the miracle, out of the victories. We want to be able to say that these victories are signs from Hashem showing us, don't worry, you will succeed against all odds. If you're going to tell me we're a mighty band of commandos, warriors, it's easier to just become Hellenists. Right? We can become commandos there too. They also had elite forces. Right? So now, and this is basically what the Maharal says, and the truth is that many of the Mepharshim say that the reason they did not make a Yom Tov over the victories until they had the Nes Hanukkah was because of this point. Victories can always be attributed to natural causes, as miraculous as it seems. Right? The Six Day War, most of us recognize as a miracle. But, you know what happened then at the time? At the time, Natzer, remember good old Natzer? I don't, it was before my times, but some of you probably remember him, right? Cousin Natzer. So, at the time, he said, with typical Arab genius and integrity, he said that it turns out that the Israelis, right, they had to explain this defeat. The Egyptians had explained to the world that they were the most mighty army around, etc., right? And all of a sudden they were creamed. So, okay, they executed their commander-in-chief. They didn't execute him. They requested that he commit suicide, because otherwise they might have to take measures against him. So he cooperated. So he committed suicide, fine. But whatever it is, Natzer said that we were stronger than the Israelis, but there were other foreign forces fighting along with the Israelis. That's what Natzer announced. There was the U.S. were helping them, and we're fighting with them. They actually were U.S. and British and French forces fighting with the Israelis. Now the problem was that the Israelis managed to pick up on a phone conversation between Natzer and Hussein, the King of Jordan, where they coordinated what they would say. They made up the story, and the story was broadcast. So it was a little bit embarrassing for Natzer, but it's okay, he got over it. He was used to this sort of thing. Whatever it is, that's what they said. So now the question is, what was it that enabled the Israelis to win? So there was a theory developed, which they stations, I don't know if it was television, radio, whatever it is, they interviewed Rabin, who was the Israeli commander at the time, and they told him that there are those who are saying that Israel actually had a secret weapon that they used against the Egyptians. And Rabin was offended. He said, secret weapon? The world just can't accept that it was simply due to the skill of our soldiers. That was Rabin's take on this. This is what it was, so clearly was the skill of our soldiers. Right? Open miracles can be the skill of our soldiers. It was for that reason that the victories were not reason enough to establish a celebration, because they could be explained away by the obstinate as natural causes. They were a mighty band of warriors. Right? The truth is, I don't know Yehuda Maccabee, I don't know if he had a much bigger build than me. Right? The point was not their military prowess or capability. That wasn't the point. The whole significance was the fact that, on the contrary, their supreme efforts on behalf of Hashem were being awarded with open cooperation on the part of Hashem. But this was still somewhat ambiguous. Here's where the significance of the Nes Chanukah came in. Through a lot of sweat and blood and tears, all very literal and all with much plenty, they finally fought their way back to the Beis HaMikdash, and they found it in ruins, basically, right? And it was a whole big cleanup project. And they lit the menorah. Now again, they were at this point where it was a very bleak situation. Like we said before, it wasn't like it was this glorious victory. The land was ravaged, they knew that they were still in danger from the Greeks. As we said before, they did ultimately end up once again being chased out by the Greeks. Wasn't a good feeling to light a wooden menorah instead of the golden one. None of this was good feelings. The golden one was gone, yeah. It was long gone. So. Yeah, it was a makeshift menorah. Copper? I mean, I'm not sure. It was either copper or wooden, but whatever it was cheap material. Okay? It's a makeshift menorah. But again, the point here was, what they were so thirsting to know was, where is Hashem here? Again, they were so not used to the nation as a whole in their historic experience, were so unaccustomed to this radio silence. They've been killing themselves for years, and they wanted something reminiscent of the good old times where Hashem would come and openly tell them, I see what you're doing. Radio silence, nothing. This itself was so demoralizing, on top of everything else. And then something happened. They lit that menorah, and they knew that even that is only a temporary business. It's going to go out at the end of the day. Then we're going to have a week with no menorah, right, until we get the oil from somewhere else. But the oil didn't go out. It continued burning. And it continued burning. Second day, third day, word started spreading. There's something going on here. There's something going on here. And the fourth day. Let's note, by the way, that this was not a new miracle. In earlier times, this miracle happened daily. Right? So the menorah used to burn unnaturally, past the time that it was able to, the Ner Ma'arovi. Really what this was a repetition of a miracle that had been regular in the past, but had since ceased. Right? But it says specifically about that, the constant presence of the fire in the Beis HaMikdash that never went out, unnaturally, was for the purpose of demonstrating the Shekhinah's presence in Klal Yisrael. And all of a sudden, this was something that, again, there had been this radio silence for years. And now they're seeing, second day, a third day, a fourth day, a fifth day. Significance wasn't lost on them. Euphoria started spreading. What was this? This was exactly what we're talking about. This was Hashem coming and signaling them in an open way. I'm with you. I see what's going on. And all of a sudden, retroactively, their victories took on a whole new feeling. This is how the Maharal explains it. He says, of course, the celebration was not because of the Nes itself. The celebration was because of the miraculous victories. But it took the Nes Chanukah in order to be able to really understand that that's what those victories were. All of a sudden, when they saw that it's burning another day, and another day, and another day, and it should have gone out, they suddenly retroactively sensed the hand of Hashem clearly with them in those victories. Now, this is a second. This was the significance of cause of celebration. The fact that, yes, we reached a period of darkness. Really, this is the significance that Hanukkah holds for every generation. We reached a period of darkness. We are not going to be restored. At least not yet. At that point in history. So the long galus ahead, 2,000 years ahead, not going to be restored so fast to the previous state. Nevuah is not coming back. The open miracles are not coming back. But yet Hashem is showing. Don't think that it's radio silence. I'm still with you just as I ever was. Things seem dark, realize that I'm right there with you in your struggles, crowning your struggles with success. This is what Hashem showed in the Hanukkah menorah, and this is what made them drunk with euphoria. This is what gave them, this is what fortified them to be able to go through, like we said before, another 21 bloody years. Now they already had the resolve. Now they saw, Hashem is with us. Oh, we can continue to let ourselves be killed. We can continue to put our necks out on the line. Now we know that, no, that radio silence is just on the surface. But Hashem is as there as He ever was. This is why Hanukkah, per se, was established as a Yom Tov, more than so many other great miracles that weren't. So we have to understand what really the significance of Hanukkah is. It's precisely the fact, let's say we said, the sun stopped for Yeshua. Why wasn't that established as a Yom Tov? The answer is, that was done at a time when the lights were on. Miracles were regular fare. The whole point of Hanukkah was that you're in a situation of darkness. You're in a situation of the post-Nevuah period. Realize, nevertheless, that Hashem is just as there as He ever was. And that He's going to crown your successes. If you kill yourself for Him, He'll be right there for you. That's why Davka Hanukkah, it's the Yom Tov of seeing the hand of Hashem in the galus, in the darkness. And that's why the truth is that when we celebrate Hanukkah every year, we're not commemorating something of the past. Really, Hanukkah brought out a point that is just as relevant in every generation, in every year. This year's Hanukkah is not celebrating the same thing as last year's Hanukkah. The fact that there is a thriving Jewish people today is uncanny. It's against all odds. It shouldn't have been. Right? You look both from the spiritual perspective and from the physical perspective. If you lived in Germany, whether in the early 1900s, right, at that point you saw that from the physical perspective, there isn't going to be much Judaism left. There aren't going to be much Jews left once the Germans have finished their work. Right? If you lived a little earlier, you understood that from the spiritual perspective. When Rav Hirsch came to become the Rav in Frankfurt, the Reform had so much taken over that there were 12 observant families left. It was the same story. Geiger was the father of the Reform, basically. Right? He was really a Talmud of Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn was yet an observant Jew. Geiger was really the first Reform. He was the father of irreligious Judaism. But he and Rabbi Hirsch competed. Rabbi Hirsch was the big champion of traditional Judaism, right? And he was a prolific writer. He wrote very, very great works defending traditional Torah Judaism, right? Now when Geiger, his main opponent, read his work, he praised him. He said that Hirsch is a beautiful writer and he's putting forth a beautiful defense. But he said he's wasting his time because he's defending a lost cause. That's what Geiger said. Right? Because it's clear that traditional Judaism is on its way. Right? Now, the Rav Hirsch Kehila that started at that time with 12 families is still thriving. Still thriving today in Washington Heights. Where's Geiger? I don't think there's any of his descendants who are still Jewish today. They became assimilated. There's nothing left of him, right? That's where Geiger went. So again, it's the nice Hanukkah. It was uncanny. Geiger was right from the realistic perspective. Doesn't really have a chance. But that's the nice Hanukkah. Things can be as dark as they seem. Hashem is there. People are willing to be moser nefesh. People are willing to push for it. Judaism will continue. And the truth is, you have to realize today also, Again, look at the Jewish world today in Eretz Yisrael. Where does that come from? It comes from the ashes of Europe, basically. Look at the Jewish world in America, thriving, right? America was considered a spiritual wasteland. There wasn't a chance of a religious revival in America. Look at it. What you're seeing is contemporary Hanukkah miracles, where it survives against all odds. And therefore, when you walk out on Hanukkah night, and you walk through the street, it's always beautiful, right? You walk through the street, you look at all the windows, right? The street is aflame with the Hanukkah lights. You have to notice that you are seeing right now an open miracle. You're seeing that same Hanukkah miracle from back then. Why? Because there really should not have been these Hanukkah lights from the natural perspective here. The Goyim, Europe, if you were in Europe 150 years ago, all around Europe was aflame with Hanukkah lights, right? But then, our enemies did a very, very determined job of stomping it all out. And they basically succeeded in Europe, right? Europe they got rid of. But, much to their frustration, they finally managed to stomp it out and boom, it flared up in Israel and in other places. This has been going on around all of history. They stomped it out in Spain, it flared up in Eastern Europe. They stomped it out in Eastern Europe, it flared up in Eretz Israel. This has been going up all over the place. They just, you know, there's a game, I don't know if you ever saw these in these arcades, they have the game, Gopher game, where basically the way it works is you stand with a hammer, yeah, and the weasels pop up and you have to bang them down. As many as you bang down, they pop up in other places. That's what the Jewish people are doing to the rest of the world. They finally managed to stomp us out, to extinguish us in one place, boom, right behind their back it flares up somebody else, somewhere else. This is what you're seeing. You have to walk out on the street, look at the street of flame and say, this is the miracle of Hanukkah of 2014. Well, that's exactly what it is. That's the significance of what we're doing here. So this is really the point to be celebrating. It's celebrating not an event of the past, but for some of what we've been discussing now. It's not commemorating an event in the past. It's celebrating the fact that Hashem is showing us, no matter how dark things seem, all throughout history, I will be there with you in the darkness. We got that clear sign back at Hanukkah, and this is what we note again every year, and this is what should make us as drunk with excitement as they were back then, to notice that it's a miracle today. It's not a miracle that happened back then. It's a miracle today, and to dance and sing because of that. Okay.